Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is August 5th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. I know it's Monday, but we're here now, so I know it's going to be a better day for you. All right, coming up, we check in on LA's Green New Deal to see what progress is being made with reducing emissions. Tag along as we hitch a ride on an electric bus. That's in about 15 minutes. Plus, we speak with the LA-based illustrator of the New York Times Modern Love column, so stay with us. We're going to start, though, in Sacramento. Lawmakers are back after summer recess, and over the next 5 weeks, they'll work through over 1,000 bills. Among them, some legislation that could change the lives of a lot of people here in the state. For a look at those, we're going to talk to Ben Adler. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for Capitol Public Radio. Ben, welcome back.
Hey, good to be with you.
All right, you're right there, too, right there at the Capitol.
Yes, I'm in the Assembly Press Bay right now. It's kind of like back to school day, except for the fact that it's only a 5 week school year. And it's kind of, you know, you could call it, you know, the final semester if you want for this year.
So they got to get a lot of work done in a little bit of time. So let's start with a big one that affects employment and how companies classify their workers. It's AB 5. Tell us what AB 5 is.
So Democrats and labor unions want more companies in California to classify their workers as employees, not contractors. So guaranteeing benefits or offering benefits, guaranteeing a minimum wage, and that can be pretty expensive for industries that have always relied on contractors. So not just the gig economy, but also older sectors like trucking and agriculture and healthcare. So everyone is asking for exemptions, and some have already gotten their carve-outs, hairstylists, accountants, lawyers, but there are other industries that want their own carve-outs, and then there's all of this attention on whether there will be some sort of special status in between employee and contractor for, you know, Lyft and Uber drivers and Postmates and DoorDash, et cetera.
And those are the ones that want the carve-outs, those gig companies, including Uber and Lyft. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, everyone wants carve-outs. Some have already gotten them.
Yes,
others
yes.
are still trying to get them, and we're all wondering. I mean, this is a lobbyist's dream because every industry needs its own representation on this and its own treatment, and there's so much money at stake for so many different industries. The lobbyist profession is doing quite well on this bill.
What could passage of this bill mean for them financially, for, say, Uber and Lyft?
Well, they will say that it would fundamentally change their business model as they know it. And there's an argument over whether, A, that's true, and B, if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think supporters of this bill would argue, hey, you know, these companies have been making money in a different kind of economy while not doing what older businesses or more established businesses have done, which is benefits and paying employer shares of taxes. And the companies themselves would say, look, we're just not the same way, and we've got our own methods, and they've done well for us, and they've done well for people in the gig economy who don't want a typical 40-hour a week Monday through Friday 9-to-5 schedule, and it's working for them as well. So that is the disconnect, and we will see where everything lands. The thing to keep in mind, though, is a lot of times in the legislature, the status quo rules. You can't quite get enough to rule the day one way or another. Well, one huge edge for labor and a big disadvantage for business on this is last year's state Supreme Court ruling that says basically right now that Uber and Lyft and other companies may very well be breaking the law in what they do. And so there's this question of not just the carve-outs, but retroactivity as well. And that's why it's seen as overwhelmingly likely that a bill will get through and that it will be friendly to labor and business. It's an uphill battle for business and tech.
All right, so moving on, a few bills aimed at charter schools. What are those bills?
So this is another issue where for quite some time the status quo has reigned in the legislature. Neither the teachers' unions nor charter schools were able to really get bills through to advance their agendas. But you've got some movement here, potentially. You've got bigger Democratic supermajorities than ever before, a governor in Gavin Newsom who certainly is not loyal to charter schools. They spent $20 million on Antonio Villaraigosa's behalf in last year's election. And so some of the efforts right now that are still alive include a measure that would shift oversight and authorization to local and county offices, and another to restrict charter schools' operations to the geographic boundaries of its authorizing office. So you've got some efforts out there that could put a very real, if not a hard cap, at least slow or potentially freeze the growth of charters.
Talking to Ben Adler, Capital Bureau Chief for Capital Public Radio, who is in the Capitol as we speak. A consumer privacy bill up for consideration right now. It aims to change a sweeping privacy law passed last year. What's being proposed, Ben?
So this goes back to, as you mentioned, last year, when a single voter, albeit a millionaire, a multimillionaire, but not a billionaire, a developer from the Bay Area, conquered a $1 trillion industry, the tech industry, because he brought forth this law from scratch. And he got paid to gather signatures for it. And then instead of going to the ballot, there was a deal in the legislature that saved everyone from spending a lot of money that enacted this law. And what it does is it gives Californians the right to learn what companies like Facebook and Google know about them and to stop the sharing or selling of their data. And they can sue over data breaches if companies fail to adequately protect their data. Now, critics, not just the tech industry, but also business groups and some small business groups say, look, unless it's amended, it's going to affect way more than just tech. Small businesses will face new costs, potential lawsuits. Civil liberties and privacy advocates want to hold the line as much as possible. We know there will be a bill with some technical fixes to the law. The question is whether what supporters of the law would call poison pills are going to be involved too, whether there will be efforts to weaken it and whether those efforts will succeed.
One more thing, Ben. Gun laws have been on a lot of people's minds lately, especially so-called red flag gun laws. They let family members and law enforcement agencies seek gun violence restraining orders against people they think could be dangerous. California has had this law in place for about 3 years. Recent shootings, though, now have revived conversations about expanding the law in California. What would change, and what's the likelihood that Governor Newsom would even sign such a law?
Well, I think that I'll take the second question first. If almost any gun measure reaches Gavin Newsom's desk, I think he is much more likely to sign them than Jerry Brown was, because Jerry Brown tended to do his little paddle to the left, paddle to the right thing on gun control measures. What we're talking about is the existing red flag law, gun violence restraining order law, lets a family member or law enforcement personnel go to court to try to get one of these restraining orders. And then if granted by a judge, officers serve the restraining order and confiscate any guns, magazines, or ammunition they find. So now the question is whether to also allow employers, co-workers, and teachers to petition for the restraining orders. And it's not just opposed by gun rights groups, it's also opposed by the American Civil Liberties Union. Jerry Brown twice vetoed similar bills, and a quote from his veto message last year around, he said, law enforcement and family members are, quote, best situated to make these especially consequential decisions. So we'll see. If it gets through to Gavin Newsom's desk, I think it's more likely than not that Governor Newsom would once again go a different way from Governor Brown.
Ben Adler is Capital Bureau Chief for Capital Public Radio, live from the Assembly floor in the Capitol building. Ben, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, there's a special election in L.A. tomorrow. Voters in the Northwest San Fernando Valley will be picking a new city council representative to replace Mitch Englander, who stepped down at the end of last year to take a job in sports entertainment. One of the issues that's been heavily debated in the council race is L.A.'s Green New Deal. That's a package of citywide environmental proposals Mayor Garcetti introduced in April. To talk about where the candidates stand on the environmental policy and why it matters, we have Emily Alpert-Reyes. She's been reporting on this for the L.A. Times. Emily, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, let's start with the basics. Who are the two candidates in the race for this city council seat?
So there's John Lee. He is a former chief of staff to Mitch Englander, the councilman who stepped down. More recently, he's worked as a consultant. And then there's Lorraine Lundquist, who teaches at CSUN, is an astrophysicist, and works in, I think, the sustainability initiatives at CSUN.
Now, where do each of these candidates stand on LA's Green New Deal?
Well, Lorraine Lundquist has, you know, generally put her support behind this package of initiatives. She says, you know, climate change is something that it is more costly for the city to not deal with than to deal with. And she's really made battling climate change a key part of her campaign. John Lee has expressed a lot of skepticism about the costs of, you know, some of these green initiatives, particularly plans to phase out three natural gas plants that are along the coast.
And is there positions kind of going on party lines so far?
that it's been expressed quite that way, but certainly, I mean, you do see kind of echoes of the national debate over the national Green New Deal, where there is more enthusiasm on the left and more concern on the right.
Yeah, and Lee, just to be clear, is a Republican. He's aiming to try and take Englander's seat. Englander was a Republican in that district. Who is supporting each candidate's stance on environmental policy?
Well, Lorraine Lundquist has attracted a lot of interest from environmental groups. The County Democratic Party has been a big supporter. You know, they're hoping to sort of flip that seat, which has long been held by a Republican. John Lee has gotten a lot of support from the union that represents workers at the Department of Water and Power, which has had a lot of skepticism, again, of that plan of shutting down those three gas plants.
Talking to Emily Albert-Reyes, reporting on the race in the city council in the Northwest San Fernando Valley for the LA Times. Why has the Green New Deal become such a key issue in this race?
I think partly because Lorraine Lundquist has really made environmental issues a key part of her campaign. I think partly this is John Lee reacting to that and attacking her on that. Secondly, you know, this is the same part of the city that suffered from the methane leak at the Aliso Canyon yeah. facility. And, you know, in talking to some of the environmental activists who've been organizing out there, you know, some of them really referred to that as kind of a radicalizing experience for a part of the city that has otherwise been seen as relatively moderate to conservative on, you know, various issues.
Have you noticed that swinging the conversation or the debate over this race that much?
I do know that you certainly get the sense that that disaster kind of haunts this district. And, you know, both candidates say that they want that facility to be shut down. There's not a great deal of disagreement on that. But I think it has made environmental issues more prominent than they might be otherwise in a city council race. You know, besides that, the big issue in this race has been homelessness and how the city should be handling the homelessness crisis.
Now, okay, so this council seat race, how does that reflect in the national debate? I know we touched a little bit on it earlier about Green New Deal policies in general.
Right. Well, again, it is something that tends to, you know, really excite environmentalists and progressive activists. You certainly see that with Lorraine's campaign where, you know, a lot of environmental groups are going out and, you know, knocking on doors for her and are really excited about, you know, trying to elect her to the seat. Nationally, there has been, you know, there have been misgivings among some of the labor unions that represent workers at, you know, fossil fuel plants that the way that this transition to renewable energy happens could potentially be detrimental for those workers. And so the fact that IBEW Local 18, the DWP union, has been expressing those concerns and is, you know, really championing John Lee, I think also echoes what something that we're seeing nationally in this debate.
In terms of the political makeup of LA City Council, what's at stake with the vote tomorrow?
Well, LA is a very liberal city. That's not going to change either way with whatever happens tomorrow. But I think for people who are more conservative, there is a concern about hanging on to what has been the only Republican on the council. You know, John Lee has, in part, you know, played that up a bit in his campaign, saying, you know, we need to keep a conservative voice, a fiscally conservative voice, at the very least, on the council. For people on the left, I think there's a lot of excitement about the idea of flipping the seat. You have seen a change in voter registration in this district over time, with rising numbers of Democrats and unaffiliated voters and dropping numbers of registered Republicans. And so for people in the Democratic Party, getting this seat, I think, is kind of a symbolic victory and something that they hope will set the stage for 2020.
Emily Albert-Reyes is a reporter with the LA Times, talking with us about how the Green New Deal is affecting tomorrow's LA City Council special election. Emily, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The Los Angeles Department of Transportation is aiming to make their entire fleet of vehicles all electric by the year 2030. I'll do the math for you. That leaves them right around 10 years to get 100% electrified. So a decade seems like plenty of time, but it's really not unless they go a little at a time right now. Coming up, how in one corner of the city, LADOT has gone all electric. It's at an iconic city landmark where you can observe the future all for yourself. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, an online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an info session to learn more. Classes start September 3rd. Apply by August 5th for up to $8,000 in scholarships at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. It was a little over 3 months ago that LA Mayor Eric Garcetti announced a Green New Deal for the city. The plan calls for a 50% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2025 to combat climate change. And it targets various sources, including buildings, electricity, trash, and of course, transportation. But the question remains, how does the city get from where it is today to where it wants to be? Over the next year or so, we'll try to answer that here on Take Two. And today, we start with how we get around. Salita Reynolds is general manager of the Los Angeles Department of Transportation. And we asked, which is a bigger driver of LADOT policy right now, the Green New Deal or the 2028 Olympics?
I would say yes. Right. We need to show the world by 2028 that Los Angeles can once again sort of demonstrate what a big city can do to turn around the story on climate. We have other things that we care about as well, things like safety, as well as correcting racial and socioeconomic inequities and getting people access to opportunities. Those are really the main three or four things that we focus on.
Now, as LADOT's general manager, what's most urgent?
Well, most urgent for us, we think, is the focus first and foremost on safety. And what we think is that you don't really have to choose. The things that are good for climate, the transportation projects that are that I would consider sort of climate action, also have incredible benefits for safety and for economic mobility for folks. So things like putting in a protected bike lane on a street in downtown Los Angeles is good because it gives people a viable choice on how to get around, particularly for those short trips that they want to make in the middle of the day. And it also makes it safer for those folks when they travel that way.
And then that goes to the next issue, because it seems like one of the hardest things to solve, Salita, is that you try to get people, drivers, out of their cars for those single passenger trips. And when public transit ridership has been declining and the use of Uber and Lyft are on the rise, how do you change what people seem so accustomed to doing?
It's a huge challenge, I won't lie. People don't typically welcome change. That's just not how we're wired as humans. But at the same time, I think we all know that our way of life has to change if we're going to preserve, you know, our future on the planet. So I try and help people think about it as you don't have to sell your car and start riding a bike every day. But if you took the bus or rode a bike or picked a different way to get around, even once or twice a week, it would make a huge difference and it would be really meaningful. And those small changes add up in a big city like LA.
Now, what about those package deliveries? E-commerce is expected to grow by 50% over the next 5 years. That means a lot more miles being logged by trucks, delivering individual packages right to people's homes, which actually, so that means people aren't getting in their cars and going to the stores to buy the same stuff that's getting delivered. But I'm wondering, Salita, how does that complicate what LADOT is trying to achieve?
So it's certainly something that we have to think about deeply. And, you know, today, a lot of those deliveries are happening on the ground. But when you, you know, look at the roadmaps of companies like Amazon and Walmart, you can see those companies starting to think about those package deliveries going airborne at some point in the future. And that creates its own set of challenges. You know, it might help alleviate some of the congestion on the ground, but it really opens up a whole new set of questions about municipal airspace and who is sort of in charge of the skies above your head. One of the interesting things, though, that I think people overlook is we think about the last Olympics, the 84 Games, as a time that LA sort of solved traffic. And the real reason that traffic was so great during those games was because all of the deliveries were focused more overnight. So big deliveries to businesses, restaurants, et cetera, all occurred in the evening when congestion is lighter and there are fewer cars on the road. So as that fleet sort of becomes more electric, can we look at strategies that focus those deliveries during the times of day when we aren't at sort of peak emissions? as a way to both solve congestion and get closer to our climate goals.
Talking to Salita Reynolds. She's general manager of the Los Angeles Department of Transportation. All right, let's talk about the transition to electric vehicles. How is LADOT supporting that?
Of our 350 or so buses that move around the city right now, we have about four that are electric today, and then by 2030, that entire fleet will be electric, including the smaller vehicles we use for paratransit. That's for people who have disabilities, and also potentially eventually our commuter express long-haul buses that take people really long distances.
What about charging infrastructure? How many public charging stations does LA currently have, and how many more are needed to support more people giving up their gas-powered cars? That's one of the major reasons people use for not going electric is a lack of places to charge.
A lack of places to charge, that's right. So we have been steadily installing a few dozen chargers. So LADOT has about 36,000 on and off street parking spaces around the city. And that includes, you know, about 130 parking lots and structures that we manage. So we have a goal to get to, you know, majority of those lots having at least 10 or 15 spots for people to be able to charge. And then with our partners at the Department of Water and Power, a plan to steadily replace some parking meters with chargers.
All right, what about other forms of electric mobility, like scooters? Some people love them, some people hate them. LA, though, has the largest dockless mobility program in the country. Any evidence that it's helping people get out of their cars and reducing emissions?
I hadn't noticed any scooters, eh? Had you noticed scooters?
A little bit.
In LA? A couple of them, maybe?
Yeah, just a few.
Just a few? Yeah, there's actually 36,000 of them all around the city. And I'll say a couple things about scooters. So in 1 month, our data from the companies that are operating in Los Angeles showed 1 million rides on scooters and electric bikes. That's a huge uptick and conversion in the way that people are getting around the city. And I think there are still a lot of kinks that we have to work out in that program. But it's very clear that, for example, in city of Sacramento, the number of trips made on the jump bike, so those are those bright red, tomato red sort of electric bikes, was greater than the number of trips that people made using Uber over a given period of time. So some initial read is that those devices are replacing some of those shorter trips that, believe it or not, people were before calling on an Uber or a Lyft to get those short distances. I think we'll have to wait and see over the course of the pilot in the first year what the actual, you know, behavior change is. Because another thing to keep in mind is that all of those devices have lithium batteries in them. And so there's a hidden environmental footprint there when you have to dispose of something sensitive like that. So it's complicated to sort of say, are these definitively great for the environment or not? But I think in the short term, we can say that Angelenos certainly think that they're a good way to get around.
I got to say, it just seems like getting emissions under control is such an uphill trek, and actually going uphill burns a lot of gas now that I think about it. So are you hopeful, Salita?
I'm very hopeful because I think that we have a toolbox of things that work, but they almost all require us to confront the fact that we need to make adjustments and changes, and we need to make those connections. It always surprises me when I talk to someone who really cares passionately about the environment, and then when we start talking about something like bike lanes or transit lanes or scooters, all of that falls away. And so what I really want people to understand is that things like bike lanes, safe routes to school, these things are climate action. And we really have to start thinking about them that way in order to get there because we know they work.
Salita Reynolds is general manager of the Los Angeles Department of Transportation. Salita, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
As we just heard from LADOT General Manager Salita Reynolds, the city's transportation agency plans to go all electric by 2030, and the transition has already begun. Today we bring you one example, the four electric buses running daily on its Griffith Park Observatory route. Earlier this month, the route was expanded with longer service hours and more efficient routing that reduces travel times as well as emissions. Take Two's Sue Carpenter brings us a story.
Most people don't even realize the buses are electric, even though 450,000 people take them every year. I'm talking about the Dash bus service that runs between the Vermont stop of the Metro Red Line and Griffith Park Observatory. The route quietly converted to electrics about 2 years ago, when LADOT started running daily service to the top of Mount Hollywood.
They're good for the community and good for the park in terms of pollution.
That's Brian Lee. He's head of transit operations for LADOT's Dash bus service. But he says the benefits of electric buses go well beyond emissions.
One, it's quiet. It does go through some residential neighborhoods, so having it quiet is nice.
Especially since the buses travel up Vermont past some of LA's most prestigious and pricey real estate, stopping at the Greek Theater and, ultimately, one of the best places to pose with a Hollywood sign. Since early August, the service has started running at 10 a.m., 2 hours earlier than before. And the route has also been revised, with only right turns that shave about 5 minutes of travel time. Now it takes about 20 minutes to get to the top of Vermont from Los Feliz. It's all part of LADOT's plan to solve multiple issues at once with the implementation of electric buses, reducing emissions, improving safety, and cutting down on traffic.
There is no quiet time at the observatory anymore like there used to be.
That's Mark Pine. He's deputy director for the Griffith Park Observatory, which has two main access roads, the easiest being Vermont.
There are very busy times like the summer or the holidays, then there are slightly less busy times, but all the time there are people here, whether it's 6 a.m. in the morning or 10:30 p.m. at night.
Pine says the bus is a good alternative to battling traffic all the way up the hill in a car, and then having to pay for parking, which is $10 an hour. That's why the observatory offers this advice on its website.
Avoid the fuss, take the bus.
Eddie Cortez works in building operations at the observatory. He doesn't own a car. He gets around the city using a bicycle and public transit. But when it comes to getting to work...
I don't bike up here. No, that's... I've tried it once. Never again.
On days when his shift starts before the bus begins running service, he sometimes springs for an Uber to get up the hill. That runs him as much as $20.
I'd rather pay 50 cents to get on the bus.
And now that the Griffith Park Observatory service is operating with longer hours, he can. Which brings us to another reason LADOT is embracing electrics, social equity, or giving more people access to affordable and clean transit. Carrie Gonzalez is behind the wheel. She's been driving buses for 27 years and has experienced their evolution from polluting diesel power to less polluting natural gas and now zero emissions electrics.
The electric buses, they're nice. The difference from the diesel and the black smoke and sitting behind buses all day was a big difference.
Right now, there are only four electric buses in the LADOT fleet, and the only place they operate is the route to Griffith Park Observatory. But next year, DOT plans to expand.
Going forward, we'll be buying only electric buses.
Brian Lee with LADOT's Dash Bus Service.
We will be getting 25 electric buses starting early next year, and then soon after that, we'll be purchasing more. I think we're going to be purchasing 150 within the next 2 years.
Those buses will be funded in part with $36 million in clean transportation grants made possible with legislation passed in 2017. And where will they be operating, you ask? That has yet to be decided. But by the end of next decade, every bus in the LADOT fleet will be electric. For Take Two, I'm Sue Carpenter.
For most of us, your identity, however you define it or whatever it means to you, is something that people take pride in. It's something that's shared to make connections with folks who are different or maybe to show solidarity with others who are exactly like you. Tragically, though, at times a person's identity becomes a target, a bullseye for hate. Coming up, how the El Paso shooting targeting Mexicans was felt by some of your neighbors right here in Los Angeles. That's coming up next when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
Another one rides the bus, and another comes on, and another comes on, another one rides the bus.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. It's been just over a week since a gunman opened fire at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas. 22 people were killed, dozens more injured. The shooter told law enforcement that he had driven more than 10 hours to El Paso specifically to target Mexicans in the attack. The aftermath of the violence has left Latinos all over the country shaken, among them three KPCC listeners who reflected on how they felt following the attacks.
In terms of what it feels like to be living in the United States as a Latinx person in the aftermath of the shooting in El Paso, I definitely feel like it's different.
For me personally, it feels like every time I set foot out my door, I have a target on my back.
I think that I've been afraid, honestly, since Trump was elected. I mean, I have honestly been afraid for other people, and now more so for myself.
As sad as it is to say, when I first heard of the shooting in El Paso, I put it to the back of my head and just added it to a growing list of massacres that have been going on in this country. However, once I learned of the shooter's intent, the fact that he drove over hundreds of miles just to reach El Paso and targeted its demographic specifically because it was largely Latinx, it definitely hit a lot closer to home than any previous shooting.
As a woman, we constantly have to have this sort of heightened awareness around us when we set foot out the door. And as women of color, there's an added sense of awareness to that. It's 2019, and that's how I feel. And whenever I feel myself just becoming sort of comfortable, something inside of me sort of wakes up and reminds me that, no, this is the world you live in. People don't like you because of who you are.
I think that there's always been hate. It's just, I think, more in the open. I feel like I'm back in the 70s when I was a child and people had absolutely no issue calling me names and saying mean things to me, telling me to go back to my country.
The shooter himself indirectly quoted some of this intense anti-immigrant rhetoric in his manifesto, and it was one of his reasons for doing this heinous act. I feel like this rhetoric is uncalled for and detrimental to our society.
I'm actually afraid. I think that I've lived with this hate, but I've never really been afraid to be somewhere. And in my job, I'm a therapist, but I'm field-based, and I have a lot of clients who are Latinos. I think often about if somebody came to harm us, because we are in public places, and some places are very easily areas where somebody that wants to target a lot of harm, just like in El Paso, you know, they would very likely harm a lot of Latinos. So I'm always looking for a way out and thinking about, you know, what I would do to protect my client and then protect myself.
You have to keep moving forward by getting out there each and every day, being proud of who you are, holding your head up high, showing up. I've always been taught to be myself, represent, and I'm never gonna stop being me. Go into those public spaces, show them who you are. And that's my big takeaway from all of this, is keep on keeping on, because we gotta show our faces. This country is a country that's built on the back of immigrants. And we gotta hold each other up, support one another.
I plan to just keep living my life, honestly. Moving forward is moving forward. We can't let these things hang us up, because then, you know, they win. If we don't gather, if we don't go out, if, you know, we become isolated and secluded because we're afraid, then we're not living our lives. We cannot let hate win.
Those were KPCC listeners Nestor De La Torre, Mary Lou Guzman, and Sandra Hybe. Do you have any thoughts you want to share about how you're feeling after the El Paso attack? Tell us by leaving a message at 626-583-5281. That's 626-583-5281. The immigrants and asylum seekers who come to the U.S. often head to places where they know people. And in Oakland, there's a growing community from rural Guatemala that speaks an indigenous language called Mam. As part of our California Dream collaboration, KQED's Farida Javala Romero went to a class where English and Spanish speakers are learning the Mam language.
And in a call to ti, Arturo.
A handful of adults sit in the Latinx Cultural Center at Laney Community College. They practice saying good afternoon in Mam with teacher Henry Sales. Later, Sales writes on the whiteboard, "Let's go eat," and shows students word by word. The students laugh at themselves through practice. Mirtha Ninayawar is taking the class. She volunteers at a Sunday school where many of the kids only speak Mam.
And I want them to hear me speak Mam so that they see that I'm also learning and trying hard to learn a different language, because that's what they're doing.
She wants the kids to feel proud of their language and culture.
I say Bantashleha for good afternoon. I hope I said that right. And then Chonti is really easy because that's thank you. And we always try to teach the kids good manners after we give them their snacks.
It helps the kids open up, she says. They trust her more.
And even the parents, too, if I greet them and Mom, they smile. And I think they feel that I care more about them.
There's no official count of Mom people in Oakland, but the community has grown rapidly to at least several thousand. And as more Mom speakers come, the city needs more people able to talk with them, to connect them to schools and services.
As there's so many newcomers, they're having a great need to serve those people, and what they have found out is that they don't speak Spanish necessarily.
Arturo Davila is a Spanish professor that coordinates the Latinx Cultural Center at Laney. He says they've gotten requests for Mam interpreters.
Interpreters for medical clinics or legal clinics.
The first waves of Mam Guatemalans began arriving in Oakland in the 1980s, during that country's civil war. Today, Mam are leaving Guatemala because of gang violence and crushing poverty. In some ways, they're finding Oakland more accepting of their indigenous culture than their home country, says Mam teacher Henry Sales.
Now that I'm here, I understand my rights and I understand like who we are. And now I feel proud, and I will teach anyone who would like to learn the language, yes.
It's not easy for Mam speakers new to the city. It's expensive. Families cram together in small apartments. It can be hard to navigate if you don't speak English or Spanish. But Sales thinks he and this class can help change that.
I love it. I love, you know, connecting communities.
At the end of class, Sales writes down the phrase for any questions.
Oh my gosh.
Look at this.
Oh man. One word has four consonants together.
You make it look so easy. Atom.
But then after practice,
bingo.
They get it. In Oakland, I'm Farida Javala Romero.
All right, if you are a night owl and love pretty, sparkly lights, then listen up. There is one heck of a show happening tonight. First awesome thing about it is that it's 100% free. Second, depending on where you live, you might not have to go anywhere to get a front row seat. Find out what it is when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. All right, so what does love look like? Well, one person who might know is Brian Ray. He's an artist and adjunct associate professor at Art Center College of Design in Pasadena. His work has appeared across the world in Paris, Mexico City, Barcelona, even maybe your living room on a Sunday morning. He's the illustrator of the Modern Love column in the New York Times. Every week, the column features a first-person essay exploring what it means to love in the 21st century. Ray sat down with local radio producer Matt Hoisch to talk about his art and how he goes from an essay that he gets at the start of the week to a finished illustration that he sends off across the country.
There have been a couple of moments where, you know, I'll be talking to people, and the thing that I always hear when I do have those conversations where people are like, "Oh, you're the illustrator. Oh, that's really interesting." The very next thing they say is, "Oh, I look forward to picking up the newspaper on my front doorstep every Sunday, and it's the first section I turn to." I don't ever try to recreate the story. In other words, I don't just redraw exactly what an author has described, partly because that, you know, that could so easily just be a photograph. And though I love photographs, that's not what I do. I had a student once who said that your style is like two lines and a color. And I was like, no, it's two colors. So I'll have some time to read through them. And what I'm doing as I'm reading it is, you know, letting it try to sink in a bit. And then the very next step I do is I actually sit down and I simply write. And what I write is a kind of shorthand version of the essay. I try to distill it down to about, you know, anywhere from like 5 to 10 words, and then sometimes 3 to 4 words. But those words oftentimes are more descriptive words. But what I'll do with those, with that shorthand version, the written version, is then I'll take that and I'll begin to sketch from that. I'll oftentimes try to put myself in the shoes of the author. Like if it's a really heavy essay, I'll think about places, moments, or scenes that might mirror the heaviness of that essay. So if it's a woman and, you know, she is struggling with something, I'll oftentimes try to recreate a scene that might kind of mirror that tone. So as an example, if I draw a woman sitting on the edge of a bed, you know, reflecting on something. If the light is on, it's a lighter moment. If the light is off, she's really isolated and she's much more alone. And that has a far greater impact and perhaps a more intense feeling. You know, as I'm sketching, I'm trying to figure out what will elicit, you know, empathy or emotion from an audience. There have been a couple that I think where I feel like I've really done my job well, like where like I matched the tone of the essay pretty well. One was actually a really funny essay about a woman who really, really, really loved her pet turtle. The drawing was of a woman holding her turtle, like the woman standing behind her turtle and the turtle standing at the edge of the front of the boat. So it's like, you know, replaying that scene in the Titanic, you know. So it's like it's the most loving moment ever in our lives, right? So that's, and of course that wasn't in the essay at all, but again, that's that situation where you're creating a parallel story, and it was one of those ones where, you know, even when I look back at it, I still kind of laugh about it. You know, my take on it has always been to treat them a bit more like visual love notes. You know, it's almost like the drawing that you might do for
a loved one before you left for the day in the morning. And then there's other ones where the drawing may not have been necessarily a drawing that I loved, but the story was one that really moved me. There was one a couple of years ago by this amazing author, Amy Krauss Rosenthal, and she had discovered that she had terminal cancer, and she wrote this absolutely heartbreakingly beautiful piece about her husband, who she knew she was, you know, going to be leaving behind. She wrote this dating profile about how wonderful her husband was, in the hope that, I mean, I'm kind of getting choked up just thinking about it, about her husband Jason, and the drawing wasn't that remarkable. It was the essay that was just so remarkable. The fact that she did this, and I had an opportunity to meet Jason recently, and I just went up to him and I hugged him, you know, and it was like meeting a brother, you know. And the craziest part of that is, you know, I have a 2-year-old son now at home, and he loves to read, and a couple of his favorite books are Amy's books. So she's always around, you know, our house. Of course, they're simply drawings, but there is a responsibility, I think, that the illustrator of the column has, because the authors of these pieces are so revealing, you know, and what they're sharing with the world, you know, and there's a massive following for the column that I have discovered over the years. As an illustrator, you tend to keep your head down, you're just focusing on the drawing right in front of you. But then when you lift your head up and you realize there's a huge audience that really looks forward to these pieces. So my feeling is that column is so unbelievably different than the rest of the news and the newspaper. And you don't know where the Modern Love column will take you. And that goes for, you know, for the artists as much as probably the people who write them.
That's Brian Ray, an LA-based artist and illustrator for the Modern Love column in the New York Times. He also has a new book out called Death Wins Goldfish. That piece was reported by Matt Hoisch with sound design by Justin Epstein. Closing out today's show, if you can stay awake in the wee hours tonight, you're in for a celestial treat. The annual Perseid meteor shower will peak just before midnight and last through tomorrow morning. The shower started over the weekend and occurs as the Earth passes through the meteor trail of the Swift-Tuttle comet. Now, hot tip, the trick to good viewing is to find a spot that's sufficiently dark with clear skies free from bright city lights. Now, that may sound like a no-brainer, but we have some local suggestions that might get you to a, pardon the pun, stellar view of the show. Mount Wilson in the Angeles National Forest, Malibu Creek and Topanga State Parks, even the nearby streets of San Gabriel Valley are earmarked for good stargazing. Wherever you take in the Perseid meteor shower, NASA says you can expect to see nature's fireworks, a sky rich in meteors and fireballs.
Starry, starry night, paint your palette blue and gray.
Now, if you stay up to take it all in, we want pictures. Send them to us on Twitter. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. And while you're there, follow your old pal, A. Martinez, as well. I'm there at A. Martinez LA. That's at A. Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. If you missed any part of the show today, just look for us wherever you get your podcast. You can get the show all right there waiting for you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.
What you tried to say to me, and how you suffered for your sanity.